So normally at this point, I ask meekly whether anyone has a laser pointer, because I forgot one. And for the past 2 years running, the same guy, where are you? There you are, has given me the same laser pointer that's been running out of batteries during my talk. This year he gave it to me preemptively and said I just put new batteries in it. So I would like a big round of applause for the laser pointer guy. I could choose to use either the tiny suppository or the giant dildo laser pointer, and I will choose the suppository. All right. On that erudite note, we will begin. So this is obviously not the exact same title of the talk from the proceedings, which was entitled something snotty like "Why You Should Have Paid Attention in Vector Calculus" or something. And I realized as I was doing this talk that that was just bad karma to like start out that way. So now we've got the upbeat, neat stuff from vector calculus and related subjects. It's also I'm going to skip a slide. It's also a new title because it's, instead of this being a talk to convince you how cool vector calculus is, I realized that I had to make a choice while doing the talk, and that was the choice was either spend an hour convincing you to use vector calculus and teach you nothing about vector calculus, or teach you a bunch of stuff about vector calculus and kind of skimp on the convince you to use it. And I decided to go more with the latter, and I just hope you trust me that it's cool. So this talk is kind of a hodgepodge. It's not a general introduction to vector calc. It's more like, here's a bunch of stuff that I found difficult to learn when I was learning to do the kind of math that I do for my game programming. So it's kind of a tour of somewhat on the surface basic examples that actually have some subtlety to them and that when combined kind of give you hopefully a grounding and intuition in some kind of difficult to get concepts or at least difficult to get techniques when working with vector calc and related topics in game math. There's a lot of different little side streets that are kind of in some sense more useful on the ground takeaway than the actual main flow of the lecture, because the side streets are all like, let me explain this one specific thing that I find really cool about this thing. So, but hopefully that arc will be somewhat interesting. At the very least, you'll come out with a lot of tips and tricks and some cool stuff, assuming you're interested, and I'm just going to assume you're interested. Prerequisite-wise, I need to assume that you... need to move my shoes. I need to assume that you're familiar with algebra and linear algebra and that sort of thing. And I need to assume you understand scalar calculus fairly well, at least at the rote, like, I can differentiate this quadratic equation. So let's get started. At the basis of all math, or a very large percentage of math, is this concept of a function. And so what is a function? A function, we all use the name, I mean, C has functions, whatever. A function in math is a thing that maps values from the, quote, domain into the range, okay? The domain and range. The domain are the inputs of the function, the range is the output of the function. It can be multi-valued in the range, but not in the domain, okay? So here, in this example right here, we have your average, like, scalar calculus function, y equals f of x, and you'll notice that it hits a couple of the same y values across here, but at each x, there's exactly one y that gets produced. In contrast, this dude down here is multi-valued in x, so it is not a function of x. It might be a function of something else, like a parametric, like t or something like that, but it is not, y is not a function of x in this one. Here we have a slightly different example. We have a parametric function that is a vector function of a scalar variable, theta. Now, this is the common, like, you know, x equals cos theta, y equals sine theta, and hey, we walk around the circle in x and y. So this is a vector-valued function of a scalar. It is a function because at any given theta, there's exactly one, there's a unique output. It's not multi-valued. It's multi-valued in a different way. You keep going around the circle. But for a given theta, you don't have to somehow produce two values. If you can see it, is a vector-valued function of a vector. It takes uv and outputs x, y. So, and we can draw that, the results of that function, the graph of that function, by saying, let's say this is the uv plane, and we draw little x, y vectors everywhere to show what the result of the function is. Now, Right. So this is discretely drawing each one of these little XY outputs, but it's continuous. Like there's a continuous combed vector field here. Just I choose to draw it by drawing a bunch of individual little guys. Here is a scalar valued function of a vector, which you can think of as like a height field, z equals f of xy. In this case, it's like a little spherical distance thing from the origin. But at every xy vector input, there's a single z output. So hey, look, it's like a little height field. Here, this guy up in the corner here, we'll talk more about later, he's an implicit function. He has f of xy equals 0, and that carves out a circle in the xy plane, and we'll talk about why that is in a little bit. So there's some functions, and not. Okay, so what is a derivative? A derivative is central to half of calculus, which is the differential calculus, and then there's integral calculus, which we're not going to really have time to talk about. For games, differential calculus is a little more important, I think, or a lot more important. So a derivative is another function, so hey, it's a function that obeys all the things we just talked about, and it's a function that maps changes in the domain to changes in the range, and this map is normalized. So what does that mean? Well, let's figure out what that means at a little, kind of a slightly deep level by talking about how we might form this. So just taking this sentence and turning it into math, we make a little change in the domain, x plus delta x, or some little wiggle in x, and out comes, and f changes and makes a delta y. So if f of x equals y, then f of x plus delta x equals y plus delta y. Delta y is how much f changed when given delta x. So kind of visual down here, hey, if I move this far here, I move this far here, right? Now, when I say we normalize it, if we take the y and move it onto the other side, subtract y from both sides, and y equals f of x, we can see that, and then we divide through by delta x, this kind of normalizes this change function. It basically says, hey, if I move, and the reason we need to normalize is if I move a really tiny amount in x, then I'm going to move a tiny amount in y. And the tinier I move in x and the tinier I move in y, if some things are true, which we'll talk about in a minute, and if that's true, we end up with this basically zero number that's not very useful. But if we divide the really tiny number by the other really tiny number, we get a finite number that's actually useful. Like it changes, if I go a unit step at this point in x, then I get 5 out of y, or whatever. Okay, so that's where this normalization comes in. It gives us a finite number back from these really tiny numbers that we're putting in. So let's talk a little bit more about the tiny numbers and what they give us. So the most important thing of all of differential calculus, and I would claim all of calculus in general, is this concept that if we zoom in far enough on a function, it's linear. It's a straight line. That is why rockets fly, that is why everything in the world works. So, because computers can't do anything with nonlinear functions, but they can do a lot with linear functions. And so if we zoom in far enough and take small enough steps, then the change, then we can treat anything, any continuous function, as linear. So, what does this mean? Well, here, let's kind of go backwards on this and start with, this is kind of chasing our tail, but there's this thing called the Taylor series, which basically says, if I have a function and I want to I want to see what values are nearby on that function by perturbing my input domain, the Taylor series will say how that function changes in a kind of structured way without knowing what the function actually is. So, you kind of have to, the reason this is backwards is because we have to do this Taylor series, we have to know what a derivative is, and whereas we're going to like, assume the Taylor series and then figure out what the derivative is from that, which is kind of cheating, but it at least illuminates one important thing, which is these changes we're talking about, the little perturbations, are so small that if you multiply one perturbation by another perturbation or by itself, it's basically zero. It's small enough that really small number by itself is pretty small, but really small number times really small number is zero. So what does that mean? That means we can ignore everything beyond first order in the delta. Okay? So this Taylor series says that, hey, if I have f of x equals 0 plus delta x, I want to perturb near x equals 0, x0 rather, it's equal to the value of the function at x0 plus this thing called the derivative times the first delta x plus this second derivative times this quadratic approximation, and then there's a cubic approximation and on and on and on. But if we're willing to look at just close enough to this x0, then boom, all those go away. And if all those go away, then what can we do? We can say, hey, the derivative is equal to the change in that in the function over this tiny perturbation. We get back to this is an infinitesimally small number. This is an infinitesimally small number. We divide one by the other, pop, assuming we're using infinite precision floating point and we don't go to zero too early on one or the other. Hey, we get back this finite number that we can operate with. Okay, so what are the assumptions that we did use to get there? That's the normalization. Basically, it says that as we get closer and closer to x equals zero, meaning delta x gets smaller, also delta y is getting smaller, which means this converges to this linearization. This is obviously not true if we have something like a step discontinuity in our function. If we, because that means this numerator here stays constant at a finite number, right? No matter how close I get to x sub zero here, this is still equal to this delta. It doesn't ever get smaller like it does over here. And then when I divide it by a really, 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 really tiny number, boom, I explode, right? Because I get infinity. So it doesn't work in discontinuous functions, which is why they don't have derivatives. Okay. So I'm going to take this infinitesimal thing is kind of weird, and like I never really sat well with it. And then I started to get more comfortable with it, and then I found this example that I'm going to walk you through, which is kind of a total side street tangent, but is really cool and kind of gets across this infinitesimal thing, or at least is a cool enough result that you start to buy it just on the merits alone. Okay. What are we going to do? We're going to prove that infinitesimal rotations in 3D are vectors. What does that mean? Well, clearly rotations, finite rotations in 3D, we all know are matrices or quaternions or this thing that is clearly not a vector. They don't commute, for example. You can't say, you know, rotating by A and then rotating by B is not the same as rotating by B and then rotating by A because they're finite. However, infinitesimally, that is true. A, B, or BA, do it in any order you want, it works. How is that possible? And what does it mean to be a vector? So let's start. So finite rotation, hey, we're going to use this rotation matrix thing. And we know that rotations in 3D are orthogonal. So if I have a rotation times its transpose, I get the identity matrix back, meaning no rotation. So that's how I undo a rotation. Okay, so an infinitesimal rotation, because of the previous slide saying that everything is linear, has to look like this. It's still going to be a matrix. It's still going to transform my vector. But it has to be a small perturbation off the identity, by virtue of the fact that if it's a rotation and it's infinitesimal, it's going to have to be really close to the identity, which is no rotation at all, right? You with me? Okay, so if that's true, it has to look like this. I don't know what this epsilon thing looks like. It might be a little perturbation on every parameter. It might be only the top left corner. We have no idea yet. We're about to, like, nail down exactly what that epsilon is. But it's going to look like this, and I can expand it out. So R prime, which is the new R, equals R plus this epsilon matrix times R, okay? Okay, we can trivially prove right now that infinitesimal rotations, in contrast to finite rotations, add and commute. How? Well, we got two rotations. Let's just multiply them out. There's two matrices, which happen to be the sum of these two matrices. Boom, we do a matrix multiplication here and a matrix multiplication here, concatenate them. Oh, but we end up with an epsilon times an epsilon. And we just got finished saying that these numbers are so small that if I multiply two of them together, it's zero. So boom, we just throw that away. And what are we left with? We're left with two numbers adding onto a matrix. Three matrices adding together. One of them is the identity, and the other two are these two secret epsilon matrices. But matrix addition is commutative and associative and distributive and whatnot, and so, hey, I can move these, I can do E1 and then E2 or E2 and then E1, it doesn't matter. It commutes, right? And I can add them together. In contrast to finite rotations, which you have to do matrix concatenation for. Okay, boom. It may not seem like we just proved something, but we just proved something kind of weird about infinitesimal rotations. Okay, let's go farther. I can actually prove that they're vectors. What does that mean to be a vector? I mean, they're clearly matrices here, so what does that mean when I say this is a vector? Well, so how do you annihilate a rotation? You go against it with its transpose, right? Like, hey, boom, I get identity. So if I do that with these little infinitesimal rotations that we've made up here, I do, you know, 1 times the transpose of itself, hey, guess what? I end up with this double epsilon thing in there, throw it away, and I get 1 plus epsilon transpose. Has to equal 1 because I just said that I'm taking a rotation matrix times its transpose, and these are, while they're infinitesimal, they are rotation matrices. So the two of those concatenated together had better equal 1. Well, once that equals 1, I can cancel the 1s, bring one of these guys to the other side, and I have epsilon equals negative epsilon transpose. What does that mean? When a matrix obeys this rule, it's called skew symmetric. A skew symmetric matrix is the negative of itself when transposed. So what does that mean for 3x3 matrices, which is what we're talking about here for rotations? Well, clearly the diagonal has got to be 0, right? Because the only number that is the negative of itself is 0. I mean, there's no other number, right? Raise your hand if you know another number where the negative of it is itself. No. Okay. So it has to, the diagonal has to be zero. And furthermore, the upper triangle and the lower triangle have to be the opposite of each other. So there's only, so there, we annihilated the diagonal, right? So now we only have 6 degrees of freedom left. Like there's 9 numbers in a matrix. Boom, 3 of them are gone because they gotta be zero. Now there's 6 left. But this skew symmetry is saying, oh, well, there's really only 3 because the top triangle and the bottom triangle have to be equal across a negative sign. So we really only have 3 numbers left in our matrix. So it's really a waste to put this thing in a matrix because it's actually a vector. It commutes, it adds, and it's only got 3 degrees of freedom in 3D. Hey, look, it's a vector. Well, what kind of vector is it? Well, if we take this and go back up here and we say, oh, let's bring the R over to the other side. So now we're going to do R prime minus R, so the new R minus the old R. We're going to get this delta R, this dr, this little bit of change in R. And it's going to equal epsilon r, right? Well, I just got finished saying that epsilon r is equivalent to a vector, and it turns out that if you multiply a skew symmetric matrix times a vector, it's the same as taking the vector part of the skew symmetric matrix, meaning those 3 degrees of freedom, and then doing the cross product. Hey, well, anyone who's done physics now, which I think is, I would assume is most people at this point, knows that the way you differentiate vectors in 3D is by doing a cross product with the angular velocity vector. And this thing is the angular velocity vector. All I gotta do, right now it's up here, it's infinitesimally small, so it's really making almost zero. But if I divide through by dt, a really tiny step in t, it becomes a finite number, which is radians per second around the axis that it's pointing. So, hey, we just proved, in a kind of roundabout, really silly way in a single slide, that you differentiate vectors in 3D under rotation using the cross product of the angular velocity vector, and that infinitesimal rotations, like, are vectors. They commute. That's why the angular velocity vector works. Weird. Okay, so, moving on. Totally random side street. Okay. So, let's go back to basics on derivatives of scalar functions. So, how does y, or f of x, change when we change x? Everybody knows the derivative of a line is a constant, right? So if I have this linear equation and I take the derivative of it, I get f prime x equals a, right? Now, there's a bunch of different ways to write this. Df dx equals a, dy dx equals a, blah, blah, blah. Here's the way we're going to write things from now on. We're going to use differential notation, which basically says this little step in f is something times a little step in x. Right? I got a dx, I multiply it linearly, because it's just a multiplication by a number, times this thing, whatever this thing is, the derivative, and I get a step in f. All of this, these notations are all totally similar, like, you'll see them all different you'll see them in books in various different ways, whatever. So, what is this saying? This says, if I take a step in x, I always am taking the same step, a, in y, right? Duh. Okay, so if we do a curve, same kind of thing, I take the derivative and I do it in this differential notation, I see I've got this little thing here times dx. This thing, this derivative, this differential here, happens to be dependent on x, meaning how much it steps f when you step in x changes depending on where you are on the curve, but it's still linear in the change. For any given point on the curve, it's linear. It just multiplies this step in x. There's just some scale factor times x equals the change in f, right? I mean, that scale factor changes over where you are, but it still is just a linear scale. So now, let's go up to vectors. But before we do that, we have to talk about the shape of matrix operations. So, when we start working with vectors, especially when we start working with differential calculus in vectors, it's really, really, really important to get the shape of your matrix operations correct. You're just going to be completely lost in the haze if you don't do this. And so, when I talk about vectors in this talk, I'm talking about column vectors, not row vectors. Row vectors, I will say specifically row vector. So what happens is we right multiply matrices by column vectors. So to get a new V, we say MV, right? For a matrix M. Here's the shape of what I'm talking about. A matrix times a vector equals a vector on the column side, right? For a column. This is incredibly important, and I'm going to diss people who do it the other way down here. So the cool thing about this is that matrix and vector operations fit together nicely when you draw them as shapes. And doing things graphically like this is a really great way of testing your matrix math. It's kind of like doing, in science, they sometimes do unit-based analysis where you say like, oh, this, you know, feet are coming in and like, you know, seconds are coming out, so I better have been dividing by feet and multiplying by seconds somewhere in my equation or something screwed up, right? So you can check an equation to see whether the units are correct without knowing whether or not any of the actual calculations are correct. So, So there's this way of saying what a matrix multiplication is, and it's kind of this verbal thing, m by n times n by p equals m by p. But, like, you really don't have any intuitive grasp of what that means when you just say it, especially if you say it fast like I do. So here's what that means visually. If I have a, b equals c, I can stack these things up, and I got this out of this book that I referenced at the end, Thomas and Finney's calculus book, and I think it's just totally genius. I can stack these matrices up so that I can just see exactly what is supposed to happen and what operations are supposed to happen. Here's A, here's B, and here's C. So, elements of C are rows of A and columns of B multiplied, you know, dot product together, basically. And this shows that because this guy and this guy have to dot product together, this size and this size have to be the same. It doesn't matter what this size is, and it doesn't matter what this size is, it'll just keep making more. But these two had better match. This works for vector matrix multiplication, matrix vector multiplication too. Like, hey, I got a matrix here, I got a vector here, I stack it up, what do I get? I get a vector. A column vector. It's the only thing. Dot products? Well, dot products are just transposed. The dot product operator is basically, you can think of the dot product operator as this special thing that multiplies and adds elements of vectors together, or, better yet, you can think of the dot product operator as something that associates with the A. A dot transposes column vectors into row vectors and then just puts them adjacent in multiplication to a column vector. And boom, what do I get? I get a scalar because there's nothing else I can get, right? So that's the picture of matrix multiplication. And it's really valuable. So it also shows why people who left multiply by column vectors are insane. It's just wrong. So first off, if you do this, if you do V prime equals VM, you're doing one of two things. You either are using row vectors everywhere in your code and don't know it, or you're totally confused. So because it can't be a column vector. This and this, you can't get a column vector out of a column vector times a row vector. Times a matrix. There's no operation that does that. Okay? So the reason it sucks to be you if you're doing this is because all of math does it this way. Okay? Sadly, some really early computer graphics people did it the wrong way. They did row vectors, and they screwed everyone in this room and a whole generation of graphics programmers. So if you start reading math books, it's way better to do right multiplication by column vectors than it is to do left multiplication by row vectors, because you're about to get really confused. So we're going to use row vectors as a very special thing starting right about now. Okay. Shape of derivatives. Now, so matrix operations have shape, and so do derivatives. Because the name of the game with derivatives is that it's all about linearity, that means that we use linear algebra to actually compute the results of derivative operations, which means we do matrix multiplication, is really all that means. And so what happens is, if I have some function f, and I take its differential df, that has to accept a delta domain linearly on the right, and it has to produce a delta range. And a linear operator is a matrix. A thing that takes a scalar or a vector on the right and creates another scalar or a vector is a matrix. Now, that one might be a one-by-one matrix in the case of scalars, but that's just a special case. So here's that one-by-one special case. A scalar-valued function of a scalar. So y equals f of x, whatever, basic calculus. If I write it out differential form, I know the shape of this, the differential of the df part, has got to be a scalar. That's what that little box means. That's one scalar, right? There's nothing else it could be. It's gotta produce a scalar, and it's got a scalar on the input, so it's gotta be a scalar, right? Okay. If I have a vector-valued function of a scalar, like that parametric curve of theta, then I know it has to be a column vector. It's got a column vector on one side, which is points in space, and it's got a scalar on the other side, which is the parameter, theta, t, whatever. And so, when I multiply something times a scalar to get a vector, that something had better be a vector. So, hey, the differential of a vector-valued function of a scalar is just another scalar, or another vector, rather. This is pretty clear, because what happens is, functions of scalars, when they get differentiated, become scalars. So if I've got a pile, if I've got a stack of them in a vector, I just differentiate each one in place, and hey, I still got a vector. I didn't do anything. However, things start to get interesting when we get to functions of vectors, whether scalar-valued or vector-valued. So I've got an entire slide for those two. Here we are. If I have a scalar that is a function of a vector, meaning I've got some z equals f of x, y. So I've got two values coming in and one value coming out. That scalar expands into a row vector when I differentiate it. Why? It has to. Because it has to take delta domain variables, so like dy, dx in a vector on the right-hand side, And it has to output a scalar. So it has to be a row vector. There's no transpose. Like when I write this out here like this, dz equals df dx, where dx is a vector. It's bold. If this is a scalar and this is a vector, df has got to be a row vector. There's no implicit like transpose or dot product hidden right here. I just write them adjacent, which means a matrix multiplication in linearity. So there's nothing else it can be except for a row vector. Does that make sense? So you can see it when you write it out in total. I have dz equals, so now I'm going to take partial derivatives of f. Partial derivatives are just like derivatives where I hold everything constant except for one of the variables. It's the partial with respect to that variable. So partial f partial x is multiplied by dx. That makes total sense, right? Yes? No, here? Oh, this notation is kind of hacked. Like, it's basically saying this is the partial derivative of that thing. So it's actually a finite number. Okay? So, yeah, this is kind of confusing. But basically, I'm playing fast and loose with everything. The other thing I'm playing fast and loose with is, like, definitions of continuity and stuff. Like, this is not a real analysis lecture, nor am I qualified to give said real analysis lecture. So I'm kind of like, woo! All right. So, hey, but this looks like a lot like a dot product. So I've got these differentials here and these like infinitesimal numbers here, and I dot them together. Except for, oh wait, there's no dot operator. So how do I get a dot? How do I get a dot product when I don't have a dot operator? Well, I had to start with a row vector and a column vector, right? So it has to look like this. Does that make sense? You see it here. Like I'm just juxtaposing. These two things next to each other, and they have to go to a scalar. So in order for that to work, in order for the shapes to work out, those multiplyings and adds all have to go together in making this a row vector. Okay, same thing happens. So what that means is scalar-valued functions of vectors expand out to the right as rows with a slot for every domain variable that can change. So if it's a 2D domain input, then I get two versions of it, the partial with X and then the partial with Y. If it's 14D, I get partial X1, partial X2, partial X3, blah, 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 all the way. I get this giant row vector. For vector-valued functions of vectors, meaning, hey, the output of this thing is another vector, then each one of those elements in the destination vector, in the range vector, is just a scalar function of a vector. So zhoink, they shoot out, and I get a matrix. So the differential of a vector-valued function of a vector is a matrix. And it has to be, because it takes a vector, and the only thing that reproduces a vector and takes a vector is a matrix that's linear, right? Okay. So now we're going to slow down again. Here's the parametric function, vector function of a scalar, right? And if we differentiate these two guys, like, hey, I get these two things, they're just stacked up. I can pull the d theta out, right? Because they both have d theta. This is just multiplications by these super tiny numbers. And I have a column, which is in the range, right? The range of my equation here is the 2D plane. The domain is theta. This derivative is still in the range. That still makes total sense, right? Each element just differentiates into another scalar, off we go. But if I have a scalar function of a vector, then that's where things get weird. And this is where scalar calculus, like, misleads people. In this case, as we're about to see, the differential is not in the range of the function. The range of this function, z equals f of x, y, is just a number in the xy plane, right? Like, it just produces a scalar. Let's call it a height field or something like that, right? Like, in this case, it's kind of this quadratic distance function kind of thing. It takes x and y, does some operations on them, and out comes a value. You could plot it, if you wanted to plot the z as up in some 3D view, you could plot it this way. But what happens, so the range of this function is just a bunch of scalars. If I take the differential, though, I get out this row vector, as we saw before. I partially differentiate this with x and partially differentiate this with y, and I put them in different slots in this row vector, and hey, I get this vector. This row vector. If I plot that row vector in this space, it's a vector that points in the direction of maximal increase in the function. So that makes sense in some ways. Like, if I've got this vector and I take this and I've got a change, a delta vector that I'm about to dot in with it or multiply in with it, if I'm exactly in line with this thing, then I'm going to change that function maximally. That's the way to go if I really want to increase it. I want to go exactly opposite if I really want to decrease it. If I go orthogonal, like these black lines, these contour lines, then I'm going along like an isocontour. I don't change the value at all. Why? Because, hey, I'm going, I, I already said I'm going along an isocontour, and the way I can prove that I am is if this is orthogonal to this, the delta of this function is zero. Hey, I'm going along the same number. Make sense? Okay. So let's go up a dimension and view our height field and convert it into an implicit surface in 3D. So it's really easy to take an explicit function like z equals f of xy and convert it to an implicit function, as we'll see later. And here we do it right here. Hey, we'll just take, we're going to write a function where, well, let me say something. This vector here is in the 2D space here. I might have drawn it on here. It's showing how to go uphill. But it's just a 2D vector, this row vector. If I want a 3D vector that says something about the surface, about this height field, I need to actually make a 3D function, first off. Then I can differentiate that. So I make a 3D function by just pulling f of x, y over to one side, and I make a function that says, hey, I want to be above the height field, I want this function to be positive, and when I'm below the height field, it's negative, and when I'm right on it, it's zero, right? When z equals f of x, y, boom, it's zero, and I'm on the surface, right? If I take this function now and differentiate it, I get this 3D differential. It happens to be the exact same thing with some minus signs in it and the 1 for the z, but it turns out that's exactly the surface normal of this thing. Now, it's not a unit surface normal. It's not been normalized. In fact, its magnitude is telling you something about how fast the function is changing in that direction, but I could normalize it, and boom, I've got a unit surface normal. I could use it for lighting or whatever, and I get this just by differentiating here. Now, you might, if you've looked at this sort of stuff before, you'll maybe have noticed that there's this thing called grad g, which is basically the exact same thing. It's the differential, but transposed to make it a column vector, and then people routinely dot that with another vector, which why bother doing that when you've already got a row vector in the first place, is my question. The grad notation is kind of like an old school, like, vector calc, when vector calc was, like, all about 3D and, like, maybe some 2D. Nowadays, everyone does this things called differential forms and whatnot, which is all super generalized to ND, and you end up just dealing with it as a row vector. But just to be aware. Okay, so let's take one more example, just to show that I'm not making this up. Let's say we have this general, like, implicit surface, and one really dumb implicit surface is a plane, right? I mean, it's pretty simple. So let's construct a plane where we know the normal, and then do the plug and chugging, do the differential, and find out if the normals match, right? This is almost so dumb as to be not worth the time, but we'll do it really quick. So I take this normal, I'm gonna do a plane with 1, 1, 1 as the normal, right? And some d. So hey, if I multiply this out, you know, the plane equation, I get x plus y plus z plus d equals 0. To convert that into an explicit function, I just pull z to one side, right? Now it's an explicit 2D scalar function of a 2D vector. And then I pull it back to the other side to convert it back into a 3D implicit surface, because this is just following by rote what we were doing before. Differentiate that, boom, 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 boom. And hey, the differential is 1, 1, 1, which matches the normal that we had there. Same scale, right? This is not a normalized normal, because this is talking about the distance you travel as you perturb in x, y, and z. Okay. Here's another example, not quite as trivial. I have a function of like a spherical distance, right, from the origin. So I say x squared plus y squared plus z squared minus 1 is my function. If I set that equal to something, I would carve out a circle, which we'll talk about, I think it's on the next slide. But if I didn't, hey, I still got this function. I can still differentiate this, and I get out this thing right here for the differential. It depends on the x, y, and z. What does it do when you plug in a given x, y, and z? Well, it gives you the normal at that x, y, and z. Now, because it's a sphere, it depends on x, y, and z, unlike a plane, which is the same, which is constant everywhere. But you can test this easily. Like, if I'm at 45 degrees and x and y are equal, hey, x, y, and z, hey, look, it's like pointing at the 45-degree angle. Basically, besides the scale factor of 2 here, as you all know, the surface normal of the sphere in a given direction is the direction itself, right? And this is just showing you that. Hey, derived with a lot of high-powered math. Okay. Oh, wait. One segue here before we go on. Another side street. A surface normal is not a vector. What does this mean? This is illustration of why it's really important to keep the shapes of your vector and matrix operations distinct. What is a vector? So before we say something is not a vector, we have to say what a vector is. A vector is a difference between two points in space. So if I have A and I have B, then I can say V is B minus A. That is a vector, as far as we're talking about. Okay. Or at least a column vector. Okay. how do vectors transform? If I transform space by some T, some linear operator, otherwise known as a matrix, there's two ways I could think of this vector transforming. I could, take its difference, I could create the vector in the original source space, and then transform the vector by the same operation as the points that I'm transforming. Or I could, maybe I could just transform the points and do the subtraction. Well, if vectors transform like points, I should be able to do either one and they should be the same, right? So let's test that out. A prime equals transform of A, B prime equals transform of B. Hey, I already said that V equals B minus A. Well, V prime, we're hoping, equals TV, right? So let's plug and chug it, distribute across the thing, boom. Hey, look, this equals, yes, it does. Okay, so vectors transform like points, right? The normal way. How do normals transform? Well, what is a normal? In this case, really what we're saying is a normal is a thing that by its very nature is supposed to, in this case, is not a thing by itself. It's just orthogonal to a vector. We're defining this as a surface normal as a thing that's orthogonal to the things in the surface, right? What a normal really is not a vector. It's a mapping from a vector to a scalar. It's a vector. A normal is a function that takes a vector and makes a scalar. Now, you can get all super high end on that with relativity and differential forms and everything. But let's see. Here's an example of how that actually plays out, why it's not a vector. If this is the definition of a normal, a thing that, we want it to stay orthogonal to this vector, how does it transform? Right? Well, does it transform just like the points, or does it transform some other way? Let's check it out. So if I have v dot n equals 0, we want that to be true in the prime space, right? So since we don't know that's going to be true, we're not sure how normals transform. We're going to use s instead of t. We know the vector is going to transform by t. We just proved it over here. So we transform both of those, and we're using the transpose notation for dot product here. So that allows us to drop this transform into the middle, plug and chug. You know, the transpose distributes across the thing, reverses them, one of them's transposed. Well, we're left with this concatenation of these two matrices in the middle of V transpose N, which we know has to equal 0. So this had better be the identity, right? Because we want them to be equal. So what does it have to be? What does S have to be to make that equal the identity? Well, it has to equal the inverse transpose, not the same vector again, not the same transform again. So in this, we've just shown that for an arbitrary transform, N does not transform with the transform that transforms vectors. It transforms with the inverse transpose. Now, if this is a rotation, S could just be the original R, the original T, and it would annihilate to 1 here. But if it's got any scalar shear in it, that's not true. You have to do the inverse transpose to get the right result out. This is why in graphics, you know that you can't transform your normals by your rotation matrices if there's any scale or shear in them. So we just proved that right here. And that is because normals are not vectors. They're actually functions that take vectors and make them scalars. Okay, here's one more example on that. Let's say I have this ellipse. Take the middle one, right? So here's a function for this ellipsoidal distance thing, and it's got this. So all it is a sphere with this little scale on x, right? If I differentiate that, I get this for the rho vector, which we say is the surface normal. Now, if I scale this ellipse out by 2, meaning the x coordinates all go out by 2, what happens to the surface normal? Does it get scaled by 2? No. If we look over here, what happens when we scale by 2? A, which is the thing that modifies the surface normal's x, gets smaller. The normal comes up, goes the opposite direction of the scale by some percentage, by some proportion. Similarly, if I scale in, the normal vector goes the other direction. So this is just an illustration. If this vector had scaled out as well, it would be pointing like this, and it would no longer be orthogonal to the surface. So, all right. Now we're going to go into actual vector differentiation. We're going to start in 2D, barycenter coordinates of a 2D triangle. By a 2D triangle, I mean just a triangle in the plane. So now I've got UV. Where's my function? Here we go. So P equals F of UV, where there's some base P0 times two edges. So U times E1, V times E2. I can walk around by modifying E. By modifying UV, I walk around in this triangle. I walk P around in this triangle. If I differentiate this guy, I get, here's the arbitrary abstract version, not depending on the value here. I get this matrix called a Jacobian, which is the matrix of partial differentials, partial derivatives of the function. So we knew it has to be a matrix because it produces a vector on one side and it takes a vector on the other. And here's what it is. It's like the partials across the top for x and the partials across the bottom for y. Now, if I look up here at this function, partial of this function with respect to u is just e1. So, hey, what this Jacobian, the actual numbers inside this Jacobian are just the columns of e and the columns e1 and the columns of e2. If I wanted to find du dv for a given, so finding dp, how p moves for a step in du dv is easy. It's a matrix multiplication. I plug in du dv here and out comes dp. That's how p moves. But if I wanted to find how uv move for a step in p, that's easy too. Because of this linearization property, this is a square matrix in 2D. I can just invert this matrix. I say, well, this is an AX equals B problem, where B is DP, I've got some known movement in P, and I do this, I may do the matrix inverse, and out comes, the DU DV, that where I moved. Now this is really dumb because this original function was linear too, so like you didn't actually, you could do that also on this original function. But if this original function was some curvilinear crazy like, you know, thing, this would still be true. Once I differentiated it, I could still find du dp, dv for a given change in dp. Okay. Now let's step up to 3D. So now I've gotten more normal barycenter coordinates where you'd see like I'm walking around a triangle on my mesh or something like that. I can still, so now I've got a 3x2 matrix, right? It's no longer square, so I can't just use regular matrix inversion if I want to go from delta P's into delta UV's. But that won't stop me because I can use what's called least squares trivially to find the answer here. So I can say, so basically in this case, this is not invertible now, right? Even the original is not invertible because it's not a square matrix. It's not linear in that sense. It's linear, but it's not square. But if I have an AX equals B problem, I can multiply by the transpose of A, and I get what are called the normal equations, and which solve a least squares problem, which basically say, hey, give me the best move in UV for a move in P, even though I can't really get an exact, because this is not square. Now, what does this mean to not be square? This is not square because I can move P in a direction that does not change UV. Right? It's just intuitive. If you think about it, the math is telling us, oh, well, I can't actually solve that because there are directions you could move P that I can't move U and V to get to. There's nothing you could do to move U and V to make P move orthogonal to the triangle. Right? This is all, that's what the math is telling you by showing you that this is a 3x2 matrix. However, if you're willing to settle for least squares, which basically means you do this normal equations thing, which is one way of doing least squares, if you look at what happens when you do this A transpose, it basically does a projection of P down into the triangle, and then it'll give you an answer. Right? It basically removed any part of P that is not in the space of the triangle, and then boom, gives you back an answer. So the math is saying, hey, I'll help you out a little bit. I'm gonna ignore any movement orthogonal, but I'll actually give you an answer. That make sense? Alright. So, implicit functions. I said this was kind of a hodgepodge, right? Okay. So, just to ground some of this, like I used this like not a month ago in math to walk particles over the surface of a mesh, like for doing particle simulation on a mesh. So, I mean, this stuff, everything in here is stuff that I use constantly, even though it seems like it's just about a bunch of circles on PowerPoint slides. Okay. Implicit functions. What is an implicit function? Let's say what an explicit function is first, and then we'll contrast. An explicit function is something like z equals f of xy. It's got independent variables on one side, and it spits out the dependent variable on the other. An implicit function is one where the variables are all tied together inside the function, usually non-linearly. It is easy to go from an explicit function to an implicit function because you've got this dependent variable here, you just move it to the other side and call it a new function, and it's a very simple implicit function, right? Z minus f of x, y. Like, it's easy to turn that back into an implicit function, too, because it started as one. But hey, if I set that equal to zero, I've got an implicit function of x, y, and z. It's just a particularly dumb one. In general, for a general implicit function, it is not easy to go to an explicit function. For example, if you take this circle down here, which is x squared plus y squared minus 1 equals 0, as we all know. Going back to the explicit version where I can say y equals some function of x is hard. I had to take a square root. It's multivalued because it's got this plus minus thing. it's a pain in the butt. And in general, it's not even this easy, because this at least was closed form, if you're willing to accept that square root is closed form. Like, then it's in general, you have these arbitrary nonlinear equations, you just can't actually do that. But what can you do? By looking at calculus, you can really easily do this on the differential, because the differential is always linear. No matter how squirrely and nonlinear the function is, the differential is always linear. And what that means is that if I'm willing to take small steps on the thing, I can always invert it. So let's see what that means. So just from a symbological standpoint, like, hey, I've got this matrix multiplication here equals zero, right? I differentiate this, I get this. If I stack it all up in a matrix, I get the differentials times each other equals zero. In the case of a 2D thing like this, it's totally trivially obvious how I can get y dy onto one side. I just divide through by partial f partial y and shove all the x stuff on the other side, and off we go. For an arbitrary large scale thing where it's more than two dimensions, you're going to have to invert a matrix problem. So what is the shape of this matrix? This matrix is not necessarily square, and in fact is usually not square, because what an implicit function, to be interesting, carves off degrees of freedom out of a space. Now, anyone who's heard me talk, like every talk I think I've given in the past 5 years, has pounded home this concept of degrees of freedom, inequality, removing degrees of freedom. But if I have XY, which is this totally arbitrary, 2D plane, and I make a scalar constraint equation, 1D constraint equation, f of XY equals zero, that carves out all of a sudden, removes one degree of freedom, and now I'm left with a line in that 2D space. In this case, it happens to be a circle. It could be some arbitrary other shape, depending on what the inside of f of XY looks like. But let's go back to our circle here and say, let me do this really quick. If I have a 3D space and I take two constraint equations, so one constraint equation in 3D might make the surface of a sphere, which is a 2D surface embedded in 3D. If I add another constraint equation, that's the intersection of these two spheres, which is going to be a line. So I went from a 3D arbitrary volume to a 2D manifold, a surface, down to a 1D line by adding constraint equations. I could ignore the second one and just solve in the way I'm about to talk about here for moving on the surface of the sphere, or I can solve both for moving on the line that intersects the two. So let's show what this means. What does this mean to pull this over here? What does it mean to invert this? Well, what it means is it says on this sphere, for example, on this circle, I can, for a given step in x, it'll tell me what my dy step is, which basically is inverting it in this local area. If I step in x, here's linear approximation to how y changes. You can see that, like, let's say I was here at the pi over 4, 45 degree angle thing. Well, that means x and y are equal, so, hey, I plug in x and y equal here, they all kind of cancel out, and I get dy equals negative dx. What does that mean? It makes intuitive sense. If I move in dx, dy changes the opposite. That happens to be that is the tangent line of this circle. We didn't actually ask for tangent lines anywhere, it's just the math automatically gave us how you get the tangent frame, the tangent plane around a point is where you step for tiny little steps in x, in this case. Okay. Similarly, if I was down here and I wanted to step in x, how does dy change? Well, I'm at x equals 0. X equals 0 in the numerator makes this whole thing 0. So dy does not change if I step infinitesimally small up here, down here. Right? That makes sense because the tangent is perpendicular, is a horizontal line. If I happen to be unfortunate enough to plug in this point and I'm wanting to solve for the dy step for dx, what happens? Well, I get a zero on the denominator, and this goes to infinity because any step in x, because the tangent here is vertical, is going to make a gigantic step in y. I could have easily just inverted this and asked for what the step in x was for a step in y, and that would have been a totally finite number. So you have to be careful. It's telling you something when it blows up. It's saying that, oh, I was about to curve back around or whatever. Okay. Whew. So now we're going to do a couple different like tips and tricks for working with what is going to end up happening if you start differentiating these functions, vector functions. These are things that I got stuck on for a long time when I was first learning this stuff, so hopefully this will help. What is the chain rule for vector derivatives? So for scalar multiplication, everybody should know that the chain rule is, dA times b is dA times b plus a times dB, right? It equals a scalar, because everything inside there is a scalar, so we're fine. For a dot product, it's a little bit weirder. So there's two ways. So what is a vector? I mean, in order to do the chain rule, you have to have a multiplication. So what is a vector multiplication? Well, there are two that are generally used. One is the dot product and one is the cross product. Let's talk about the dot product first. If you're talking about vector functions of scalars, it's just the same as a normal dot product, right? Because a vector function of a scalar, like of, you know, f of t or something like that, is just another vector. It doesn't actually expand out unless it's a vector function of a vector. So, hey, I differentiate and I just get the derivative, which is another vector. I dot them together, I get another scalar. I'm done. If the vectors in the dot product are functions of vectors, we have to be really careful about the shape as we go through this. We know the result has to be a row because, hey, we're taking the derivative of a dot product. So the derivative of a dot product is a scalar. The derivative of a scalar with respect to a vector is a row vector, right? So whatever we do, we had better end up with a row. So the dot product operator is this weird special case operator kind of thing that, like, what is it? So but by looking at the transpose picture of it, at the matrix multiplication picture of it, we can start to elucidate what's going on in here. So if we just did it... If we just did it out normally, like A transpose dA transpose B, then we do the derivative of dA transpose times B, and then the derivative of, and then A times A transpose times the derivative of B. Right? That's just distributing it just like we did for the scalar. So what does that mean? Well, here's the picture. Uh-oh. How do we do to take the derivative of a row vector? We haven't talked about that at all. We know how to take a derivative of a column vector. It expands out into a matrix. So that's right. That's fine right here. But what is this? This has to be something, we know what the shape is though, this has to be something that takes a column vector on the right and makes a row vector to add into this other row vector. What takes a column vector on the right and creates a row vector? Nothing we are used to dealing with. This is actually a tensor and we just don't want to go there. So, we pull a little sleight of hand that is totally legal. So you could write your tensor math library and like actually just evaluate this and be done with it. But if you want to stick with your normal math library, we can pull a little sleight of hand and actually get a result. Okay. The dot product is commutative. What does that mean? That means A dot B equals B dot A. What does the chain rule do? The chain rule takes one multiplication and right before it's about to differentiate it, it splits it out into an addition of two multiplications, and then differentiates the opposite guy on either multiplication, right? We can let the chain rule do that. It's just right before it's about to differentiate our crazy row vector, we can transpose it so that it then differentiates a column vector. It's still the same math. You can work out the math under the hood. But what happens here is that we just always want to be differentiating column vectors or scalars. We don't ever want to have to let it differentiate a row vector because we don't have to write the tensor math library. So by doing the transpose here, we haven't changed the value of anything. We've just made it so it always is differentiating column vectors. It's just we swap which one is which. We still are differentiating alternate vectors. And so we get a row vector times a matrix. This guy expands out into a matrix. This guy expands out into a matrix. Row vector times a matrix equals a row vector. Hey, we've got the right shape. A little bit fast and loose with the whole like swapping it out thing, but it works. Okay, and it's actually correct. If you do out the math in the tensor arithmetic, it turns out to be the same as if you had swapped it. Let's do a really quick dot product derivative example. I'm going to say, so just to show where this kind of stuff is applicable. Okay, I've got this vector r, which is between p and q. I want to know how is the length of r changing, the squared length, which is easier. How is the squared length of r changing as I move p around and keep q fixed? Well, I define r as p minus q, and then I say r dot r, which is here's like three different ways of writing r dot r, including this fancy, looks like a square thing that the physicists use a lot just because it's like less crap on your page. So I want to differentiate that. It's a squared length. If I want to do it all the way out, I am differentiating this. I use my fancy dot product switcheroo, but both of these are the same, so it really didn't matter. And I get, and I end up with 2 times p minus q transpose, right? It's a row vector. It's the right shape. Dp, which is a column vector, which is how I'm moving p. Now, let's see. What does this say? This basically says, if you take this transpose out of here, it's basically r dot. So it's 2 times r dot dp. R is our original vector, dot dp, which is the little differential we're going to make. What is happening here? This makes total intuitive sense. This is saying, if dp is perpendicular to R, this dot product goes to zero, and the length of R is not changing, which makes total sense, right? If I move this vector exactly perpendicular, infinitesimally, you know, a small distance perpendicular, the length of R is not changing because that vector is basically rotating. If dp is exactly the opposite of R, the dot product's negative, and hey, dr is shrinking, or R squared is shrinking. The dot product, the derivative is negative. If it's exactly in line with it going the other direction, it's growing. This makes total sense. Okay. Let's do cross products really quick. Cross product is the same thing except for it's a vector function of vectors. Instead of producing a scalar, it produces a vector. So the result has to be a matrix, right? If we take the differential of a vector function of a vector, we get a matrix out because it has to take a vector on one side and produce another vector. The only thing that does that linearly is a matrix. So, but we run into the exact same problem. If we just naively try and differentiate across the thing, then I have this side is fine again. I got a matrix times the derivative of a vector, which is a matrix. So that those two multiply together to make a matrix. But here I've got the derivative of a matrix has to produce something that times a column vector equals another matrix, another weird tensor. But just like dot products are commutative, cross products are skew commutative, meaning A cross B equals negative B cross A. So right before we're about to differentiate, we can swap as long as we get the negative sign right, and we're always differentiating the column vector on the right-hand side. How does this work? Here's a groovy little example. If I want to differentiate a cross product of a vector that can move relative to a constant vector, that gives me how the cross product changes over time or as this vector moves around, right? So if I say R cross N, that, you know, you do the right-hand cross product thing and you get C pointing out of the screen. The derivative of this is basically saying, if I move R, how is C changing? It's kind of an interesting thing to ask. Like, how does the cross product change in a continuous manner as you move one of the vectors? Well, now we have the tools to answer that question. We differentiate C. So we make it the skew symmetric matrix version of cross products. So we turn it into a matrix multiplication. Then we do the switcheroo on which guy is there using the skew symmetry thing. And we end up with negative n tilde dr, t tilde is the skew symmetric operator for a cross product, plus r tilde dn. Dn is constant, so dn goes to zero, or n is constant, so dn goes to zero. And we're left with negative n tilde dr, which is basically just negative n cross dr. So, if you think about what this means geometrically, hey, as dr goes this way, I cross n cross the change in dr, and that's the direction that C is moving. And you can see how this all works out, right? If r just grows, like let's say r just gets longer, then n cross r is pointing the opposite direction, but it's the negative, so hey, C is getting longer. Simultaneously, similarly, if it shrinks, if it moves the other direction, etc. If R is going up towards N, right, then N cross DR is zero, and this thing's not changing, if it's exactly collinear. Because, hey, that vector is changing its angle but getting longer. So the cross product with the sign in it is, the angle's changing but the magnitudes are staying the same, are getting longer to compensate. So anyway, this makes intuitive sense, and so we just figured out, hey, so it turns out in physics you need to differentiate cross products a lot, but even it's just interesting by itself, like how does a cross product affect things as a continuous function? And here's the answer. Here's how it's just another cross product in a different direction. Alright, I'm totally out of time. So here are some references. Total hodgepodge. All of this stuff, comes out of a few books and I'll put these on my website. I'll put the slides on my website so you can get them there. But there's a couple of books. Like, this book is awesome, and it's like $5 from Dover. So it's just totally amazing. And it's all the modern view of calculus with all these differential forms and whatnot. And it really helps you figure out, it helps you see the vector version, how the scalar version is really just a super special case and kind of is misleading in some ways. The cool picture of matrix multiplication came from this, and Goldstein had that wacky... Goldstein's a great mechanics book that has a lot of cool math in it anyway. This is what had that awesome derivation of the infinitesimal rotations. All right. There's my lecture. Thank you. Well, I did. D6.com. Thank you very much.